you going to tell us who you work for?
I was always very interested to meet you. I heard so much about you from Vesper. The real shame is that if she hadn't killed herself, we would have had you too. I think you would have done anything for her.
Well, you know you're not in Britain, and God knows where you'll be tomorrow. Which should tell you that eventually you will tell us about the people you work with. And the longer it takes, the more painful we'll make it.
You really don't know anything about us. It's so amusing because we are on the other side thinking, oh, the MI6, the CIA, they're looking over our shoulders, they're listening to our conversations, and the truth is you don't even know we exist.
Well, we do now, Mr. White. And we're quick learners.
Oh, really? Well, the first thing you should know about us is that we have people everywhere. Am I right?
Yep, the first thing you gotta learn is we've got people everywhere. They're just not wearing uniforms and having rallies and marching down the street. Well, it is May the 20th today in Indiana, North Central Indiana, P.O. Box 401, Warsaw, Indiana, 46581. And it's an overcast day, but warming up. I was out early this morning with a tractor I just bought. Not a new one. Oh, no. I never buy new. Yeah. And it runs great. It ran great till I ran over a drop cord and wound it around the spindle. Stupid. Anyhow, I got to let the grass dry off. It's about a foot tall. Got to let it dry out before I can mow the damn stuff. Well, this is Freya's Day, Ladies' Day, She-Wolf Day in the bunker. Yeah, this show is dedicated to all the ladies out there.
Born in the heat of the desert, my mother died giving me life. Despised and disliked by my father, blamed for the loss of his wife. You know, Lord, I've been in a prison for something that I never done. It's been one hill after another, and I've climbed them, Lord, one by one. But this time you gave me a mountain. Tired of the grief and the strife, tired of working for nothing, tired of being my wife. She took my one ray of sunshine. She took my pride and my joy. She took my reason for living. She took my small baby boy. And this time you gave me a mountain. A mountain I may never climb. It is
a great one from Marty Robbins. What a singer he was. Well, let's see. Let's go to the Spanish-American War today. And then we'll only have one war left, and that's First World War, and that'll be on Moon's Day. For almost a century, the Spanish possession of Cuba had been regarded with disfavor by certain elements of the United States, and I can imagine who. The real estate speculators that would like to get a hold of Cuba, the military people thinking, boy, we need that for fortress to protect America and all that kind of stuff. Reasons for this attitude varied from those of acquisition grounds of manifest destiny. That means God gave us the right. After manifest destiny came the people with the highest altruism. I wonder what the hell that was. Maybe that was the early form of the mob that wanted to put gambling casinos down there in Cuba. When the Spanish-American republics won their independence during the early years of the 19th century, Puerto Rico and Cuba remained in the possession of Spain. Thomas Jefferson advocating the acquiring of Cuba and its annexation as a state. That would have been a very bad racial mistake, chiefly for fear that it would be acquired by England. Later, pro-slavery leaders wanted to take the island in order to extend the slave territory, bring more Negroes to the area of the United States, as had been done in the case of Florida and Texas. Cuba's annexation was a part of the Manifest Destiny program, which was rampant in the years preceding the Civil War. Yeah, that really helped us out. It's killing us today. All these non-whites coming through from the Philippines and Puerto Rico and Dominican Republic, all these places with all this free access to the white homeland. Many filibustering expeditions were sent there with an annexation in view. The Cubans themselves often came to the United States, became naturalized citizens of the country, and would return to Cuba with an unfriendly attitude towards Spanish authority, counting for protection on their American citizenship in case of trouble. This happens all the time now. This country is full of people, non-whites from all these countries, that drag their religions and their politics here, get a certificate of citizenship, and then go back and cause trouble in the countries they came from. It's a common occurrence. If they get kidnapped or something, then the State Department wants to send the Marines in to get them, piss on them. There had often been spasmodic rebellions or outbreaks in Cuba before 1895. In 1868, there broke out what was known as the 10 Years' War, which lasted until 1878. But the causes of these conflicts were never clearly understood by the participants on either side. That figures. Sugarcane was the principal source of Cuban wealth, and sugar, as I've told you over and over again, is a poison, according to the customary, and it weakens when the Egyptians, I believe it was the Egyptians or the Romans or one of those groups, introduced sugar into the diet of their soldiers, their effectiveness as soldiers dropped like a rock. That's in the book Sugar Blues, and you ought to get it. According to the customary policy of trade barriers, Spain imposed duties on goods coming from the United States, and the United States imposed high duties on Cuban sugar. These duties severely hurt Cuban economic life, and as an economic depressions, as well as prosperities, are always attributed to the party in power, regardless of the real causes, the Cubans, no exception to this rule, blame the political power then in authority. During this 10 years war, many filibustering expeditions were secretly fitted out in the United States by and for the Cubans. In other words, interfering with Cuban politics. In 1873, a ship, the Virginius, sailed under American colors carrying men and supplies to the Cuban insurgents. It was captured by a Spanish gunboat. The crew and the passengers were given a trial, which resulted in the execution of 53, of whom 8 claimed to be American citizens. Immediately, the war cry went up in the United States. But due to the wise policy of President Grant, it never gained headway. That must have been one of the few things that Grant did right. His administration was the most corrupt administration of the century. Finally, in 1878, Spain agreed to forget the past, abolish slavery in Cuba, and admit delegates from Cuba to the Spanish court or parliament. The Cubans agreed, and hostilities ceased. All men in Cuba were given the ballot if they paid taxes to the amount of $25 annually, which still excluded the poorer classes. Of the representatives sent by the island to the Spanish Parliament in Madrid, about 1/5 were Cuban-born. This arrangement lasted as long as the economic life of Cuba was normal. But in February 1895, a new war for independence broke out, which was caused by a severe depression of the sugar industry, resulting from the repeal of the 1894 of the McKinley Tariff, which had admitted free entry of Cuban sugar into the United States, giving the Cuban sugar industry access to the United States market. The closing of the United States to Cuba's sugar was a great blow to Cuba's sugar industry. Spanish authority in Cuba was held responsible, and warfare was soon established between the insurgents and Spanish authorities. A humane governor general tried to suppress the insurrection peaceably, but without satisfactory results. According, General Weyler became governor general of Cuba on February 16, 1896, and inaugurated the concentration policy by which the inhabitants of Cuba were assembled or crowded within certain military camps, concentration camps, for it was impossible to distinguish the loyalists from the insurgents. As a result of this, there was great suffering and destruction. Gomez was leader of the insurgents. He destroyed all the property he possibly could in an endeavor to compel the United States to intervene. By attempting to destroy Spanish authority, Gomez hoped to secure the help of the United States. The insurgents were often led by Cubans who had come to America, obtained United States citizenship, and returned to the island claiming the privilege of their acquired citizenship. Yeah, right. Between February 24, 1895 and January 22, 1897, a 74 persons claiming to be citizens of the United States were arrested by Spanish authority because of their activities as insurgents. But fully 3/4 of those arrested were Cubans or sons of Cubans who had been naturalized in the United States. We got that same thing big time now. It's a confusing mess. Often the insurgents developed their plans on American soil and secured military aid here. The federal government took precautions to prevent this, but many expeditions were made in spite of action taken to prevent them. Our Department of State, one of the most corrupt departments in the U.S. government, and should be eliminated or the people in there put in prison. I'd say half or two-thirds of our racial problem in this country that comes from other countries is caused by the State Department. They're the ones who bring all these Ethiopians and Somalians and all these people in and just set them down in white communities. There's got to be more to that than just economics. Our Department of State protested to Spain against the concentration policy in Cuba carried out under Governor General Weyler. But Spain contended that her methods in suppressing rebellion in Cuba were no more severe than the methods employed by our government during the Civil War, which is true. But that's different because we're exceptionalists. The United States is exceptional. We don't do things like that. Attention was called by Spain to the Sherman's march through the South and to Sheridan's activities in Virginia. Spain also called attention to the Cuban junta in New York and claimed that the principal insurgent assistance came from American soil to undermine the Cuban government. Congress appropriated $50,000 for relief of Americans in Cuba, but up to the fall of 1897, only 6,000 of the 50,000 had been used, so little need was it there for it. In this war in Cuba between the insurgents or rebels and Spanish authority, both sides destroyed all the property possible, although the insurgents destroyed more than the Spanish authorities. It was not nearly so destructive as our Civil War. Yet what should we have thought had Spain protested against the conditions of the Civil War? Such a protest would have been treated with contempt. Oh, it always does. They always do. We had no more legal ground for questioning Spanish authority in Cuba than Japan today would have in questioning or protesting against our policy in the Philippines. In fact, 2 years later, in our guerrilla warfare with the natives of the Philippines, we adopted the same concentration policy as we shall see against which we then protested to Cuba. William Randolph Hearst, who was then the leader of American Yellow Journalism, had at this time developed his chain of newspapers from California to Boston. Early in 1897, he began advocating intervention. Now, remember, William Randolph Hearst was the inquirer of the day. Appeals were made daily. In fact, he's the one responsible for getting marijuana to be outlawed and criminalized because it interfered. He didn't want the hemp industry interfering with some of his, I guess, cotton investments or something like that. And still, it's today, we're still finally just getting out of that that situation. Appeals were made daily. Stories, crimes, and conditions were pictured in his paper and greatly exaggerated. Don't they always? New York Times, New York Post. Mr. McKinley, opposed to intervention, became president on March 4, 1897. Mark Hanna, who had elected Mr. McKinley president, now wished to be compensated by an appointment to the United States Senate from Ohio. To create a vacancy in the Senate, Mr. McKinley appointed as his Secretary of State Mr. John Sherman, who was then Senator from Ohio, and Mr. Hanna was appointed by the Governor of Ohio to the United States Senate. As Sheridan rings a bell in my mind, something to do with the banking system, and it was a negative thing. Mr. McKinley appointed of John Sherman as Secretary of State was a great blunder. Here we go. Mr. Sherman was then very old and rapidly declining. His work was left in the hands of his assistants in the Department of State. United States citizens owned wealth in Cuba to the amount of $50 million, and our commerce with Cuba amounted to $1 million annually. No, that's $1 billion annually. Wow. These interests, of course, demanded intervention. Our Department of State, in its correspondence with Spain, estimated that $16 million worth of American property had been destroyed in Cuba at the close of 1897, for which properties Spain was held responsible. See, the insurgents were the ones destroying more property than Spain would. This was a greatly exaggerated figure, for at the close of the war, a claims commission was created by Congress to investigate those claims. And this commission recognized as valid claims amounting only to $362,252. That's quite a difference. In October 1897, Spain recalled Governor General Weyler and appointed in his place Blanco. The concentration order was revoked. Spain offered the natives a large share of self-government with their own constitution and legislature. Autonomy was granted. If it had been offered 3 years before, this would no doubt have solved the problem. But now it was difficult to reconcile the two factions in Cuba. The native Spaniards in Cuba opposed home rule, as it would give the Cubans too much power. The Cubans wanted independence and were unwilling to cooperate with the Spaniards in home rule. A Cuban parliament was called on May 4, 1898. The Hearst newspapers were then demanding intervention on the part of the United States and molding public opinion in that direction. Although the election of 1896 was over and it had settled the issue of free silver, yet another social elements had entered American politics through the election and campaign of 1896, and it was in the interest of some people to make use of a vigorous foreign policy. In other words, occupy, take over, steal, to take public attention away from the new issues. That's an old trick in Washington. It's an old trick by all governments. This is an old device for obliterating home issues or differences. Lincoln had been advised to precipitate the United States into foreign war as a means of preventing civil war. On February 9, 1898, the New York Journal, a strong advocate of intervention, violated the sanctity of the United States mails by securing through criminal methods a private letter written by Lomey, the Spanish minister at Washington, to a friend. In this letter, Lomey severely criticized McKinley and spoke of him with contempt. This letter was published in the New York Journal. It excited public opinion and was, of course, made use of by the Jingo Press. However, it had nothing to do with the case, for a foreign minister naturally has a perfect legal, moral right to have any opinion of the president or any other public official he likes, and to express it privately to a friend. The actual crime was in stealing the letter from the United States mails, but that action was never investigated or punished by the United States, which should have been done. Lomey's criticism of McKinley had been unjust, but he had a personal right to do it. In the midst of the great excitement created by the Lomey letter, another incident took place of advantage to the war party. On January 24, 1898, the Maine was ordered to Cuba on a friendly, quote, friendly, unquote, visit. Sure. This trip was accepted officially as a complimentary visit, but privately both Spain and the United States regarded it in an opposite light. After being in Havana Harbor for 3 weeks, the Maine was blown up on February 15, 1898. Remember the Maine now became the slogan of the war party. Spain denied any connection with its destruction, and probably didn't do it. And no one now believes it was blown up by Spain. The actual cause of the explosion is not known, but it is now believed to have been done by the rebels in Cuba for the purpose of securing intervention of the United States. It may have been an accident which Spain could in no way be connected, yet at the time the eyes of the public, Spain was held responsible. McKinley during this period opposed intervention, but the war party, supported by the Hearst newspapers, there you go, was growing rapidly. Our able minister in Spain, General Woodford, was also opposed to our intervention. Congress, however, held the opposite attitude. A senator said to Assistant Secretary of State Day, quote, Day, doesn't your president know where the war declaring power is lodged? Tell him that if he doesn't do something, Congress will exercise the power themselves. Congressman Botell, who had was opposed to the war, says that 40 to 50 Republican members of Congress held a caucus and sent a committee to the president stating that unless he asked for a declaration of war, they would propose a resolution for war and carry it through. There you go, warmongering Republicans. I want you to advise the president to declare war, they said. He is making a great mistake. He's in danger of ruining himself and the Republican Party by standing in the way of the people's wishes. So, the people's wishes. Congress will declare war in spite of him. He'll get run over and the party with him. Rhodes and McKinley and Roosevelt administrations on page 64 says McKinley feared a rupture in his own party, and on account of that fear had not the nerve or the power to resist the pressure for war. We may rest assured that if Mark Hanna had been president, there would have been no war with Spain. McKinley was opposed to the war up to the last of March 1898. Only two members of his cabinet were in favor of war. Also, the vice president was against it, as was Mark Hanna, Speaker of the House, and nearly all the leading Republicans of the Senate. On March 29, 1898, McKinley sent his ultimatum to Spain demanding the complete abandonment of the concentration policy, the granting of an armistice to Cuba, and the opening of peace negotiations through himself with the insurgents. Spain replied granting the complete abandonment of the concentration policy and did not refuse to grant the armistice, but told their minister, General Woodford, that she would gladly grant it if the Cubans, who were the resistors, asked for it. But Spain could not first offer it. Our minister at Madrid then cabled McKinley that the Spanish government and the people wished to settle the difficulty without war, and that in a few months' time he would get peace in Cuba with justice. Cuba and protection to our great American interests. Let us say, for example, that Japan had sent an ultimatum to McKinley during the Philippine insurrection, demanding that he change his policy of coercion and grant an armistice to the Philippines. Such a demand would have been treated with contempt, yet that is what we demanded of Spain. On April 6, 1898, the representatives of the Great Britain, Germany, France, Austria, Russia, and Italy made an appeal to McKinley to continue peaceful negotiations. The Pope also intervened for peace. He asked the Queen of Spain to comply fully with our ultimatum. Accordingly, on April 10, McKinley was notified by the Foreign Office at Madrid that Spain would grant the armistice. But on the following day, Monday, April 11, 1898, McKinley appeared before Congress and asked for a declaration of war against Spain without informing them of the latest concessions made by Spain. It is impossible to explain McKinley's actions. Through the efforts of Minister Woodford at Madrid and others, a diplomatic victory had been won only to be thrown away by McKinley and Congress. The Spanish minister at Washington was notified that the president, in his message to Congress on April 11th, would explain the concession made by Spain, but this was not done. A reference only was made to it in his war message. War was declared on April 18th by a vote of 324-19 in the House. You see how war happy these congressmen and senators get? They're like little fucking children. And 67-21 in the Senate. On March 31st, 1898, Woodford had cabled McKinley, quote, "I believe the ministry are ready to go as far as and as fast as they can still save the dynasty here in Spain. They know that Cuba is lost. Public opinion in Spain has moved steadily towards peace." Then on April 3rd, 1898, Woodford sent this message to President McKinley. "The Spanish Minister of Foreign Affairs assures me that Spain will go as far and as fast as she can. I know that the Queen and her present ministry sincerely desire peace, and the Spanish people desire peace. And if you can still give me time and reasonable liberty of action, I'm sure that before the next October 1st, I will get peace in Cuba." Again, on April 10th, the day before the declaration of war, Woodford notified our Department of State that before August 1st, he could secure autonomy for Cuba, or recognition of its independence by Spain, or a secession of the island to the United States. He then added, "I hope that nothing will be done to humiliate Spain, as I'm satisfied that the present government is going and is loyally ready to go as fast as far as it can. It was an open secret that Spain would give up or sell Cuba as soon as she could." One cannot read the Woodford dispatches and fail to see that the Spanish-American War was thrust upon Spain by our jingoist yellow press, headed by the Hearst Syndicate. President McKinley overestimated its strength and lost his nerve, fearing the disruption of his party. Spain was not surprised but stunned when the United States declared a war which cannot be defended on any grounds, and thousands of white men died. Cuba was Spanish territory, and we had no more legal right to intervene than Spain. For example, had a right to demand that the United States change her methods of government in Alaska. Morally, the war was indefensible, for Spain had conceded and was ready to go to any extent to avoid war, even to the point of granting independence to Cuba. This conflict with Spain cost $300 million, not including the indirect expenses. So the war machinery people, the war manufacturing people, made a lot of money on that, as they always do. And they're always behind all of this invasion shit and occupation. The most important result of the war was our acquisition of the Philippine Islands. That was a big, bad mistake. In February 1898, about 2 months before the war was declared, Admiral Dewey of the American fleet was ordered to Hong Kong, China, and instructed to be prepared to begin operations against the Philippines in case of a declaration of war. Until after the Battle of Manila, the American people had practically never heard of the Philippine Islands. These islands were taken, however, and at the peace conference, Mr. McKinley instructed our commissioners not to be satisfied with anything less than the entire group of islands because of the commercial opportunity. Ah, commercial opportunity, going to make some Jewish money here. Unfortunately, most of the people involved in getting that money were not even Jews. They were white people, non-Jews. They were secured as a trading base in the Orient. At that time, it seemed that China would be dismembered by the European powers, and that unless we secured the Philippines, the United States would have no share in the Orient. This was our first step in a policy of imperialism clothed in mild terms. For 3 years after our capture of these islands, the natives put up a guerrilla warfare to resist the United States forces. During this period, the American Army resorted to every description of barbaric torture. Among other measures, the policy of concentrating the inhabitants in camps was resorted to. which was the same policy we objected to the use by Spain and Cuba. Concentration camps. Prisoners of war were executed in retaliation for crimes of which they knew nothing. One of our notorious army officers, known as Hell Roaring Jake Smith, commanded that every building in a certain area be burned and every native over 10 years of age be killed. These 3 years of guerrilla warfare cost the United States $170 million. All of this cost and cruelty, and I'm not even talking about how many white Americans died there, aside from unjust, was unnecessary, for the natives of the Philippines were willing to cooperate with the United States to develop their civilization by peaceful methods. The resistance was caused by the presence of the United States soldiers in the island. In other words, self-fulfilling property. The American Army moves in and there develops a guerrilla occupation, or a guerrilla force. Let's see, I think that's the end. Yeah, so another ridiculous, costly war where thousands and thousands of white men died. And then, of course, out of all this, Teddy Roosevelt come out of this period, of course. And see how we're always electing generals for presidents? Up until lately, we've elected generals for presidents. And I say that the Roman rule of not allowing a military leader to sit in the halls of the country, the top leadership, the Senate, that they, in fact, whenever in Rome, whenever a man became a senator, he had to get rid of all his property and everything and leave whatever he had out someplace else, but he couldn't use it for the term he was a senator, which was a very good idea. They had to divest themselves before taking a seat in the Roman Senate. This imperialism created by the money power in the United States was never good for the white race, any more than it's good for the white race now. So there's several wars there that were drummed up to make money and to grab somebody else's property and going more and more in debt. Millions and millions and millions in debt. And who makes out? War production people, the armaments makers, the banks, all of that. But the white race doesn't really gain anything in the long run. It never does. So we have to change our way of thinking about what we support and what we don't support. Think about it. Well, here's a report from Stray Dog back there in New Germany. ATT, that old Donnie Trump spoke yesterday in New Germany, guess where? A place that we talked about before, the Lawrence Armory. That's the place where they babysit all those machines of war that white men has built. $200 a ticket, made it out of my reach to attend the event. Newspaper reports no violence and the vendors made thousands of dollars selling trinkets. This is nothing more than a carnival for the dum-dums. All those who vote for Trump help to feed the system. The system became legitimate with your vote, even in the primary, especially in the primary election. Our job is to stave the system and not starve the system and not to feed it. I love watching Trump, however. I will not be voting on June 7th. Even if Trump were sincere, he cannot change a corrupt, rotten system. Well, you got that right. Well, here go the Jews to try to corner the Arabs. They're always messing around. Bob Silberman, a Jew who spent most of his diplomatic career in Muslim-majority nations, will now reach out to Muslims in his own country. The American Jewish Committee recently hired him as its first U.S. Director of Muslim-Jewish Relations. Yeah, in other words, you're going to have Muslims here. Well, we want to have some control over them. As a U.S. Foreign Service officer for 27 years, the Des Moines, Iowa native served in Israel, Azerbaijan, Tunisia, Egypt, Turkey, and Iraq, Saudi Arabia, and Sweden. Probably opened the doors for all those ragheads to move up into Sweden and have sex with all those beautiful blonde girls. And he retired from government last year. Now 58, he works at the New York headquarters of the 110-year-old American Jewish Committee, which was founded to combat discriminations against Jews or stop criticisms of Jews, but has historically defended other minority groups as well against the white man. Yeah. Through Silverman, the AJC hopes to strengthen Muslim-Jewish relations in the U.S. at the expense of the white race, and then duplicate the model in Europe, where tensions have heightened between the two religious minorities, where the organization is about to open its fifth office. Silverman talked about his new assignment with RNS. This interview has been edited for length and clarity. We're not even going into it. I just wanted you to know this is one of the methods the Jews use to infiltrate everything and control from the inside. Well, for all you Trumpites out there, Trump makes a play for mestizo evangelicals. Trump aides have told the National Hispanic Christian Leadership. Now, I want you to understand that 85% or more of these people that claim to be Hispanic are not Hispanic at all. A true Hispanic could trace his background to the Iberian Peninsula of Spain and white people. If you've never traveled in Spain, you have to understand that there's a large percentage of the Spanish population that are as white as you and I. These people he's appealing to is the stupid mestizos, the mixed race people. And anyhow, it says here that the presumptive Republican presidential nominee will submit videotape remarks to be played at their annual conference Friday evening. He's trying to build bridges to the mestizos. Well, I'm not going to read any more of this trash because the same old bullshit. People get all excited about some guy that's going to run for office, and he's got millions of them follow him around now. Trump. Same old shit, new day. Well, the black KKK is working their ass off to stay on top in Chicago after six of his relatives were brutally slain in their Cage Park home in February. Diego Uribe was among the grieving family members struggling to cope with the unspeakable loss. He visited the Martinez family's tiny brick bungalow often, coming over to hang out or play basketball with the kids. Uribe, 22, seems devastated by the killings, even breaking down in tears at the funeral. Quote, "I hugged this kid," said Dawn Valenti, a crisis responder who assisted the Martinez family with the burial. That image was shattered Thursday as Chicago police announced the shocking first-degree murder charges against Uribe, saying the nephew by marriage had killed all six victims, including two children, in a robbery that turned into a massacre. His girlfriend, Jafes Ramos, was also charged in the six killings, but police were cagey about her exact role in the slayings. Well, this wasn't actually Negroes or Untouchables. It was another Untouchable. These were mestizos killing everybody. So that goes on all the time, too. But at least they're killing other non-whites. That's one thing. They're not... That gives the white race a rest. You know which city's got the highest percentage of Democrat voters? Well, Baltimore, Maryland, population 621,342. 87% of the voters voted Democrat in 2012. And guess what? 87% of the voters are probably black. Tuskegee, Alabama is 87% Democrat. And they're very high percentage of blacks. Rio Grande City, Texas, 86% Democrat. Yeah, let's see here. Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, 85% Democrat. San Francisco, California, 83% Democrat. You see the non-whites go Democrat all the time. St. Louis, Missouri, 83% Democrat. Oakland, California, 79% Democrat. Eagle Pass, Texas, 79%. Taos, New Mexico, 78%. Decatur, Georgia, 78%. And that's it for that list. But you see, that's how we'll never win this thing at the ballot box, because the seeds of our total destruction are already there at the ballot box. You got to get rid of this government. I'm telling you, I don't care. You say, well, you can't get rid of the government. Well, by God, sooner or later you're going to have to, before you're totally bred off the planet. You're not going to democratically take the country back. So, whether you like it or not, that's the story. Well, Pearson, a girl by the name of Pearson, or a woman by the name of Pearson, is a rising star in Trump's group of spokesmen, and she's not an Aryan. She's not black. She looks very Hispanic to me, or mestizo. She got black eyes and black hair, so there you go. Well, Chicago, you're really working at it to try to get the title for the whole country on this shootings by mostly Negroes or colored people or whatever. At least 20 people were shot over 16 hours in Chicago on Wednesday into early Thursday, including a 12-year-old boy shot while at a restaurant and a couple in their 20s shot in the South Loop during a road rage incident that began on Lakeshore Drive, police said. The boy and some friends were entering Golden Fish and Chicken in the 200 block of Southwestern Avenue shortly before 7 when a red SUV pulled up and shots were fired, according to Officer Kevin Quaid, a police spokesman. The boy suffered a grazer wound to his leg and was taken to the Stoger Hospital in good condition, the police said. Boy, it's a good thing blacks are bad shots, because it would really be, it'd be twice that many. I'm just thanking God, the boy's older brother, Johnny Lindsay, told WGN-TV. Well, I don't think that old God's listening to you, boy. Some neighbors watching police said they heard 9 or 10 shots. Others said they heard as many as 15. The intersection of Western and Jackson was partially blocked by yellow tape on the southwestern near the restaurant. On the northeast corner of the intersection, broken glass littered the pavement. Large bullet holes were visible in the window glass on the Jackson side. The road rage shooting happened about 7 hours later, shortly after 2 a.m. Oh, Chicago, my Chicago. Just a little bit of ambient noise from a cop from a shooting there in Chicago, where a bunch of untouchable Negroes were around a car screaming at each other and giving the cops a lot of shit. The cops are gotten afraid of them. They're afraid to lose their job or go to prisons. So these young blacks are talking to the cops like you know, like they were all Negroes. Well, let's check in on our old buddy Max Kaiser and see what the economy looks like here and see what he's exposing today.
Yeah.
welcome to the Kaiser Report. I'm Max Kaiser. Epictetus, the Greek-speaking Stoic philosopher, born a slave, said, "Freedom is the only worthy goal in life. It is won by disregarding things that lie beyond our control." So many things that lie beyond the control of central banks, governments, empires, and yet they can't help but have so much regard for these things that they must try so hard to control all they behold. So alas, freedom is, though a worthy goal, never won. Wow. I'm feeling philosophically endowed right now, Stacy. Not to mention stoic.
Yes, I was going to say you look very stoic.
I feel stoic.
Epictetus. That sounds like the first Instagram.
I'm not a sophist.
Okay. Well, so let's look at a form of freedom, which is hegemony, or as they say here, hegemony, or something like that. So hegemony is the freedom to impose your will upon other nations and other people around the world, and empires always have this power. And I want to look at this first headline here regarding the end of hegemony. The end of hegemony, question mark? Russian bond yields plunge below pre-U.S. sanctions levels. With Russian stocks among the best performing in 26 and up dramatically since the White House issued its sell rating. And here's the Russian stock market, the MICEX. And here, right here, is where the White House said to the world investors, "If I were you, I wouldn't invest in Russian equities right now." Remember when they said that? That was last year. Well, it's up 50%. You've lost 50% in gains since then.
Hey, if you were in a margin account, you're then 100%.
Wipe out. Well, that's quite good for them. And so despite the White House doing their best Jim Cramer impression and trying to get you to sell right when it's, or Goldman Sachs is good at doing this as well. Goldman Sachs often calls the top and bottom, but for the opposite for their clients. And then Zero Hedge goes on to say, after the stock market, despite the White House saying dump Russian shares and the shares went up, well then, it appears another key element of Americans' hegemony is also breaking down. When the U.S. and its European vassal states unleashed sanctions on Russia in July 2014, it sent bond yields spiking from 9% to over 14% as political and social risks were priced in as demanded by Treasury. However, despite the ongoing sanctions and the pressure, whether implicit or explicit, from Washington on oil prices, Russian bond yields have disobeyed America and are back below 9%, the lowest level of risk since before sanctions were imposed. And here's a chart for that. U.S. sanctions imposed July 16th, and it's now back to below there. The way the media, the way the White House, the way the Treasury presented it, the way the BBC and many state cheerleaders, and that includes NBC, ABC, MSNBC, Fox, they all basically said that when the spike happened in bond yields, that it was they who were controlling it, that they were doing it, and yet the markets are bigger than they are.
Well, you know, Jim Rogers is over there. He said Russia's a big, huge buy. He's the co-founder of the Quantum Fund with George Soros. The guy's a freaking monster investor. He's been right for 30 years. He knows these markets really well. And I said many times that the Russian bond market was a huge buy. And, of course, that was absolutely correct because the hegemonic ability of the so-called world's only superpower has been diminishing every decade for a few decades now. The U.S. dollar as a percentage of global transactions has been falling steadily every quarter for 20 years. It's approaching that level sub 50% where you could say the U.S. dollar is really no longer the world reserve currency. That means that you've got countries now competing more on an equal footing. And when you look at an economy like Russia, it's not as bad as these paid shills like CNBC are telling you, or Bloomberg.
Well, but also, again, like they were not free to see the facts before them. People, the analysts were not free to see the facts before them, and the heads of of the secretaries of state, the foreign advisors, the foreign analysts. They were not allowed to see the facts in front of them. So, for example,
why weren't they afraid to see the facts?
Because of the need to control the narrative by the empire. As I was saying, they were telling these people
they
what
couldn't
to
see the facts.
They couldn't see
they
the facts.
They were deluded by their bias.
So recall that you and I covered here over and over in the media. You saw the fact that many analysts said Russia would default, like in the 90s, even though none of the facts are the same. They had a huge surpluses. They had huge foreign exchange reserves.
If they were going to default Avira over there at the Russian Central Bank, wouldn't have cut the ruble free and have a trade in
that's what they did. That's how they fought right there.
Yeah.
Exactly right there.
That's what they did.
2 weeks
later. Because she's a brilliant central banker.
Okay, but again, what I'm saying, we're talking about here is freedom and slavery. Here is a man, Epictetus, who was born a slave. He understood what freedom was. And here we have people who are born slaves to certain narratives and to certain debt narratives and financialization narratives. And they can't see the facts in front of them because they don't even want to be free because they don't know they're slaves.
Born a slave who became a gladiator.
This guy became
a gladiator who became a legend. Maximus.
Well, this is a man who...
Am I not entertained you?
Well, that was a man who was born a slave and died a Stoic. So,
I don't want to die a Stoic.
So regarding Zero Hedge, look at that. What they say is, with the Fed's impotence on show for all to see, did the Treasury's jawboning and Washington's control of the world just lose its power? I'd say they never really had any power over it because, again, the markets are bigger than them. And also, I want to point out that this need to control and the way central banks need to control everything, they need to control the global finance, the empire of debt. Well, they've taken interest rates down to zero. On top of that, they flooded the world with liquidity, which means there's a huge pile of cash chasing yield. So this is why you have people, this is chasing yield as well. So it's hard to make enemies when you've created a class of people who are chasing yield.
Well, if you bought these 10 years at this 16% level for 10 years, you'd be equaling the performance of Warren Buffett. That's about what he had compounds money at.
Well, that's a good point to make. And now let's move on to another... Well, a nation which has been trying to control its markets and its destiny and its debt collapse and has failed for over 30 years now. Never has BOJ done so much for so little benefit. This is a headline from Bloomberg News. And they say, even after arranging a record stimulus program and reducing a key interest rate to less than zero, the central bank has failed to boost inflation to its goal of 2%. Stocks are a little changed from where they were in October 2014 when Governor Haruhiko Kuroda expanded his package of asset purchases. Exports are declining. One measure of bank lending is at a 14-year high, though loan growth is slowing compared with a year ago. While most sovereign bond yields have turned negative, corporate borrowing costs are lagging behind. So here's a nation which has been basically a slave to their policies, which have not created freedom. In fact, they're less free. They're less free to maneuver because the Bank of Japan is now out of bullets. They have nothing else left in their arsenal, so they're no longer free because they felt for all these years that they had to intervene, that they had to control the markets, that they wouldn't let certain banks collapse, that they had to control, that they knew better than what the markets knew.
Well, they've gone to negative interest rates.
They have.
Like some of these European central banks.
That's indeed true.
Because
I'm sounding like a Stoic here.
It's very Stoic of you to say that. And for decades now, 20, 25 years, the place to get cheap money has been Japan.
Yes.
That they financed the yen carry trade to buy cheap property in Europe. That's what happened in Iceland when they used the Swiss franc carry trade. They blew themselves up by borrowing cheaply in Switzerland. But most of the world borrows money cheaply in Japan at 0%. Now it's negative interest rates. That's the foundation of the global Ponzi scheme, is the Japanese central bank and their ability to make money available at zero or now less than zero. It's a hugely popular trade. It's one of the most traded currencies in the world. It's definitely in the top three. And any time you see the Japanese yen trading up, it would be like the SEC coming to arrest Bernie Madoff. If you saw, if Bernie Madoff looked down the corridor, remember it took like 3 or 4 times before the SEC finally put the cuffs on Madoff. They came and they looked, they said, oh, it looks like a Ponzi scheme, but that's all right, we'll come back later. And then after 3 or 4 times, they finally arrested him. Japan is very similar to this. They see the global economy coming down the corridor to blow up their Ponzi scheme, and then they go, oh, we'll go negative, we'll go negative, we'll go negative interest rates. But at one moment, that yen is going to start to trade up, and there's absolutely nothing that's going to stop it from trading up.
It is trading up. It is actually trading up, which is why their exports are down. It's up hugely since they've cut to negative, so it's had the opposite effect.
Because
I'll tell you what in the next sentence, in the next paragraph, why the yen has gone up, why they cannot control what the markets do, and that is because Japan might be starting to run out of road a bit of them on the monetary policy front, said Andrew Kokin, the head of sovereign ratings for the region at Fitch in Hong Kong. He said that would tend to undercut one of the sources of support that sovereign ratings have had. So they've run out of road. They've tried to control so much, they've run out of techniques and methods of control.
Yeah, but we've heard this before. And let me explain something about how these global markets work. There's a hedging book on a global basis where you've got stocks and bonds and currencies all trading concurrently. And in the case of the Japanese yen, who you've got the Japanese central bank who's buying stocks on the open market through their exchange-traded funds.
They're buying like 80-90% of their own bonds. At least, Russia still has that. Many other countries still have the notion of buying their own bonds.
The global hedge fund industry, which is trillions of dollars, is trading off the Bank of Japan with shorts and longs and derivatives and various other instruments that they are unwinding or winding or unwinding. So the fact that the yen might be appreciating could be a function of a squaring of these global hedge fund books in the short term.
Sure, but also
I'd love to see the yen skyrocket and the whole thing blow up. Sure, of course.
Because they're also out of bullets. They're not free to do anything else. They're entering a new dimension. And this is finally what Kuroda says. He's the head of the Bank of Japan. He says he reiterated on Friday that the Bank of Japan will, quote, take additional easing measures without hesitation in terms of three dimensions, quantity, quality, and the interest rate, if it is judged necessary for achieving the price stability
target. Yeah, the four arrows, if I remember.
So
he shot the four arrows, and it was a big nothing burger. Now he's got three dimensions.
He's three dimensions. There's many dimensions out there. Right. He could probably
Priest
occupy
will be
those.
Down to two choices.
But
either blow us up or go home.
Here is
and then he'll be down to one choice.
Here is a central
pull the pin.
Here is a central bank beyond all other central banks who have tried so hard to control deflation, and they are not free anymore because they cannot stop deflation, no matter what they do. They're not free.
And we're free to go to the second half. Stay tuned for a whole lot more.
Well, there you go, boys and girls. Max told you about it and his sidekick there, how the world economy's gone to hell in a handbag, and it's not going to get any better. And you realize that all is zero percent interest that they're talking about. If you're on a pension and you have saved all your life and you're supposed to be collecting a pension, where's it going to come from? Where's your money going to come from? Millions of people are going to lose their pensions. Oh, we'll have another bunch. We'll have to make a lot more cars for people to live in. That's it for today. I'll be back Moon's Day.
Patience and fortitude, and things will come your way. Will spoil the strongest lot with patience. tattoo. Rhinestone wears away the night
with facial fortitude.
Same applies to Meg and White
with patient fortitude.
Patient fortitude. Slow and steady wins first place with patient fortitude.